Thanks, everyone, for coming. I'm Marisha, and I've got the pleasure to welcome y'all to Tryon Life Farm, where we have the pleasure of hearing Larry Korn present and share about his experiences in working with Masanobu Fukuoka and maybe throughout his experiences as in the beginnings of the permaculture movement. Some of you may have seen the book The Future is Abundant, and so Larry Korn was one of the editors of this, and he translated Fukuoka's One Straw Revolution into English, and now it's come out in another printing, so that's prompted him to come out and travel around. So I'm so pleased to turn it over to Larry.
Thank you. Well, I can't tell you how happy I am to be back in the Pacific Northwest. Yes. I did a lot of work with Tilth in the early years, in the late 70s and early 80s, and it was exciting times. The One Straw Revolution came out, and the Tilth people were really excited about it, and the very next year, Permaculture won, and Bill Mollison with Permaculture came as well, and it was just very exciting. It was wonderful. Tilth was a ragtag bunch of visionary hippies, basically, and it was a regional organization. There was great vision and almost no resources. And the newsletter that Mark Music and Barbara Snyder were putting out during those years, it came out, they were putting it out in this little room in a freezing cold barn that leaked. And now, so that was then, that was 30 years ago. And also we put out The Future is Abundant. And during the 4 months that I worked on that book, I was living in a little dome tent out in a field of clover during that time when it was snowing. And I loved every minute of it. You know, that's the way it was. And now, Seattle Tilth has 15 full-time employees. The Oregon Tilth has 25 full-time employees. All kinds of good things are actually happening on the ground. There's organic farms everywhere. There's farms like this. There's farmers markets. These were all things that we dreamed of. And now they actually exist. And I took about 30 years off or 25 years off from the time that I was up here. Most of the time I was in Northern California. I worked on nurseries, and I worked for the California State Department of Forestry. I'm a soil scientist. Soil is my thing, pretty much. Well, plants and soil, of course. You can't just be soil scientist. It's got to be plants and soil. They're two sides of the same coin. And now, coming back up, thank goodness the One Straw Revolution is back in print after 25 years, and it gave me the excuse. I bugged the publisher, and I said, how about if I go on a little mini book tour? And they said, great. And I said, great, because I could make contact with my dear friends from a long time ago and meet the new generation. For example, the permaculture design course that's going on right now, and it's so familiar. It's so much like being at home. And so I'll just say that permaculture and the whole sustainable agriculture movement has grown so much during these years. And, well, unfortunately, the degradation to the landscape and to the soil and to the forest and so forth, unfortunately, that has also progressed during the last 30 years. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We are here to talk about Masanobu Fukuoka. This is Fukuoka Sensei when he was about 62, 63 years old, the time that I met him. He grew up on Shikoku Island in a small village where his family has probably lived for 700 or 800 years, farming the same fields or right nearby for all of that time. He was educated. He became a plant pathologist. He went to Yokohama. He got a job inspecting plants that were leaving Japan and inspecting the plants that were coming into Japan. He had never been outside of his village before. He kind of burned the candle at both ends. And one night after he had been up all night, he was sitting there kind of bleary-eyed, looking out over Yokohama Harbor, and a heron flew by. And a heron in Japanese literature, when a heron flies by, something is about to happen. And what happened with him was that he had an insight, just a flash came to him, and it had to do with the relationship between what the relationship could be between people and nature. And he saw that nature, as it had evolved and what it is perfect. And human beings, with their limited understanding and intellect, try to use nature for human benefit. When that happens, there's got to be a side effect, because the intellect is not just right. So there's a side effect, and the side effect, well, then people have to deal with the side effect and fix it. And sometimes it can be fixed easily, and sometimes it can't. But either way, it's using the same process that created the first problem to solve the second problem, and then another side effect turns up, and it's certainly going to be worse than the other problem, and then fixing that one, and one after the other, problem after problem. And that's how we find ourselves in the fix that we're in, is what he was thinking. This was in the mid-30s, and it was at a time when science and technology was just coming to Japan, and people thought that that was going to solve all of the problems. So he tried to explain it to other people, and they didn't really understand or give him the time of day. And what he decided was he's going to go back to his father's farm and apply this way of thinking to agriculture to create a concrete example, so that if people said, "I don't understand what you're getting at," he can say, "This is the application of this way of thinking." And beyond that, that this way of thinking could have real benefit to human society. So the first thing he did, he went back to his parents' orchard. He was the oldest of about, I think, 6 children, but he was the oldest son, so he was destined to inherit the farm anyway. He just came back a little early. And the first thing he did was he killed 150 citrus trees by accident. Okay, because he thought, well, if nature is perfect and it's human activity that's off, then why not just leave it to nature? But the trees had already been pruned. They had already had the benefit of human thinking. And once he left them unpruned, the branches crossed, the air couldn't circulate properly, insects developed, and eventually the trees died. And so then he said, well, wait, once people have affected nature, then people have a responsibility to fix it. And in the case of the orchard trees, if a tree has already been pruned, then he went and examined the way trees grow and the natural branching of wild trees. And so he said, trees that have already been pruned, I'm going to prune it back as closely as possible to what the natural form would have been. But for every tree from now on, it's going to be a single main leader. I'm not going to take any nursery tree that's had the leader snipped. And it's going to be a single main leader with the branches growing out in whorls or opposite as trees grow, because that's the optimum shape of a citrus tree. And of course, the trees grow a little bit bigger, and it's hard to harvest. It's not as practical, but the trees grow better, and they're in much better health. So then he said, well, he noticed that following this way of thinking, that he noticed that he couldn't help but notice that the soil in the orchard was completely wasted. It was the topsoil was gone. He was farming on subsoil. It was so hard, he said, it was hard red clay, so hard you couldn't stick a shovel in it. He says, how am I going to improve the soil? So what he did was he used plants, and for the most part, Fukuoka Sensei uses plants to do the work. It's so easy, you just scatter seeds and put a ground cover, and if you do it right, then the plants will do the work. And the plants that he used for soil improvement were daikon was his top, deep, straight taproot. And then all the other brassicas, mustard, other radish, you know, and eventually gobo, burdock, comfrey, and it's what we find in the permaculture course. They call them accumulators, dynamic accumulators, because the roots just go nuts, lots of them, and they go down into the subsoil and recirculate the nutrients that have gone down to the subsoil, bring them back up to the surface. And then he just mows the top and lets them fall down. It makes a living mulch. And then he added a nitrogen-fixing ground cover. He tried about 30 of them. He knew he needed a nitrogen-fixing ground cover, but what he didn't want to do was say, you know, I think it's going to be crimson clover. I think it's going to be medic. I think it's going to... No. He put out 30 of them. And then he observed very closely. And the idea was, it's not what I think, it's what the feedback that I get from nature. And after 2 years, it was clear. White clover did the job so much better than all the others. And that's because white clover is a nitrogen fixer, which adds nutrients and goes perfectly with the clover and the mustard. And then weeds started, grassy weeds started coming in. That's good. And then the clover and the soil starts to get rich, but the white clover, the roots mat right on the surface in the top 2 inches, and it helps to control weeds, especially grassy weeds. And just to jump ahead a little bit, Fukuoka said, for no-tillage agriculture, solving the weed problem is really crucial. And he did it with white clover all the time, white clover in the rice fields and in the orchard, and mulch. That's essentially how he solved the weed problem. And then he had the challenge of how do you improve the soil deep down, the subsoil. So at first he said, well, maybe I'll dig trenches and take trunks of trees, you know, trees that have died, and we cut them down, and then we'll put the trunks and the branches in trenches, and that'll become organic matter that will work down into the subsoil. And he did that for about a year or two. And then he said, wait a minute. This can't be right. This can't be the way to do it because it's too damn much work. And that was a clue to him. If it's a lot of work, it's not right. It should be easy. It should be easy. And he calls his farming do-nothing farming. I mean, if you're a farmer, you have to work. There's no way around it, especially if you have 10 acres of orchard. He has 10 acres of orchard and an acre and a half of rice and barley fields. But it's unnecessary work, and this seemed to him to be unnecessary work. And it's one of the reasons that he doesn't particularly, he doesn't make compost. Too much work. But to be, just to give you the whole picture, right outside, okay, there's his wife Ayako and the family. He raised 5 kids, which for some reason he never mentioned in any of his books. I don't know why, but there's a house in the village where the kids were raised and Ayako lived, and there was a vegetable garden right outside the back door. It's a typical organic garden, just like the Rodale garden. It's based on the Chinese organic gardening that F.H. King described in the Farmers of 40 Centuries. And there's a compost pile. It's the only compost pile in the whole farm because it's a way to get rid of kitchen scraps, and the intensive labor is appropriate right outside the back door. But then when you go out into the fields and so forth, he much prefers to just let the plants do the work and just spread everything out on the surface and let it compost right on the surface instead of Yeah. So one last thing about how he developed his way of farming. When he went back there with this idea of developing a farming system that didn't contradict that vision that he had, he had no model to go by. Nobody else had ever done it. Nobody had tried it. He didn't even know. He had no idea where he was going with this. So, but his one principle was, he said, most people, when they're trying to develop a new system, they go, well, how about trying this and how about trying that? His way was opposite. Well, what if I didn't do this? What if I didn't do that? And he looked at agriculture and he said, why are we plowing? Why are we flooding the rice field? Why are we spreading herbicide? And one by one, he peeled all of those things back until he came to the point, which was right about the time that I met him in 1972, where he said, well, it's come down to this. All I do is scatter seed and spread straw, but it took me 30 years to come to this simplicity. So he's getting rid of all of these things. You know, remember I mentioned that there's one side effect, and then we do something to solve that, and then we do something to solve that, and then he peeled them all back and went in the opposite direction until it became so simple. But it's very sophisticated. And he told me once that the key for him came about 8 or 9 years after he had started farming, when he had gotten used to by walking the fields every single day, all of that time. And then he got to see what the patterns were. You know, I'm sure we're talking about patterns in this permaculture course, and the pattern and the sequence of weeds. He said, once I understood the sequence of weeds, then I knew exactly when to come in and do what I needed to do at just the right time. So when I say it's simple but really sophisticated. Well, before we do the slides, if you don't mind a digression, I want to tell you about something about myself, about me, and how I met Fukuoka. And the reason I want to do that is because I want you to, when I came to his farm in 1972, I want you to see what I saw, okay, and the significance of it, okay? I've always been interested in Asia. I'm not sure why. When I went to, after high school, I went to Berkeley and studied Asian studies. And after I graduated, I just went to Asia for adventure, just traveling around. I met a really interesting community of people from around the world who lived in Kyoto, and also this group of Japanese, I'd call them hippies, but they call themselves Buzoku, which is tribal people. And these were young people that were very idealistic, and they had just gotten off, they just weren't doing what was expected of Japanese person of their age. What's expected in Japan, it's unbelievable how rigorous that is. And these were people who were off on the side, in the margins. And they were the back-to-the-land people. It was the early 70s. They were connected with, they knew people in New Mexico and Arizona and Colorado. And they had communes here and there. And I became friends with them, and I hitchhiked around from one commune to the other. And on one commune, a small island called Suwanosei, two things happened there. It was a beautiful island with a volcano that was erupting about half the time, and there was a commune that was founded by Gary Snyder and some of his beat poet friends from Japan. And the two things that happened for me there was that I heard about Fukuoka, and people had great respect for him as a spiritual teacher. And they knew that he had a special way of farming, but they didn't know what it was. Nobody had ever been there before. And the other thing was that I just fell in love with plants and soil, and everything I've done since the time that I was at that commune has involved plants and soil. So I came back to the United States, went back to Berkeley and studied soil science and plant nutrition. Berkeley was a perfect place for me to go for that particular study, because Berkeley had not been sold out to the chemical companies and the agribusiness people. That would be like UC Davis, Michigan State, Ohio State, and some. But Berkeley, the people that studied soils loved soils. And that was 28 of us. There were 28 undergraduates in a school of 30,000 people studying soils, which now, soils is a backwater when it comes to science because you can't make money studying soils, but you can studying how to mine the soil of organic matter using industrial farming. But that wasn't Berkeley. So after studying for a year and a half or so, and all of this, how soils form and the landforms and the relationship of all the microorganisms and the plant roots in this magical, magical world, the professor one day walked in, and he was dour. He was not the chipper, bubbly professor that we had seen all the time. And he said, well... Today we're going to talk about agriculture. And basically the lecture was on what happens to soil when you plow it. And it was heartbreaking because this soil, this magical world, well, first of all the plants are completely eliminated and all the relationships of the microorganisms are destroyed. The soil structure is messed up. All the horizons, the different layers are all mixed up. You leave the soil open for erosion. You have to build a factory to create the tractor to do all the work and then all the fossil fuels. And then because you have no more insect control after you've eliminated all the habitat for insects, then you've got to start spraying herbicides. And then because you burn out the organic matter, then you've got to start using chemicals and all the pollution that comes from that. So that was a real, like, sobering hour to listen to that. And then one of the students near the front, I remember, she said to the professor, well, if plowing's so bad, why do we do it? And he said, we just don't know how to grow crops any other way, was his answer. This is high level, you know, science. This is where they were at that time. They're still, well, no. That's where they were then. And so I filed that. My friends from Kyoto moved up to a place in the mountains north of Kyoto, high in the mountains. I've got some pictures of their place where I lived for a while. I moved back and lived with them. We were doing traditional Japanese farming the way they did before World War II, except that we used a kind of an oversized rototiller. All the way through World War II, they were farming fields in Japan using horses and oxen. And then the mechanical tillers came in only after World War II. Anyway, so I did that for about a year and a half, and then I said, you know, I'm going to go down and see Fukuoka. You know, I've heard about them. Let's see. So I hitchhiked down there, and I came. I remember it was right after lunch. It was 1 or 2 o'clock. I had a big old beard and long hair, and I saw the rice in the field was very strange. It was about 2/3 the height of normal rice, and it was loaded with grains per head, and it was a dark green color, like olive green, instead of this palish green. The kind of tall, spindly, palish green was the typical, and here was kind of stunted, it looked like almost, but looked full of vitality. So Fukuoka sensei came over, and we started, you know, I introduced myself, and we had this little conversation in Japanese, and I told him that I'd been farming and up in Kyoto, and I came down to see him and so forth. And then he said, hey, have you ever seen rice like this before? I said, no, never. And he said, that's because the soil in this field hasn't been plowed for 30 years. And so... wow. You know, remembering what that professor said and seeing that, it was like discovering the Holy Grail or something like that. Here was an example of somebody that was successfully growing grain and getting yields that were comparable to the neighbors without plowing. And nobody knew about it. So I felt like, among other things, the luckiest guy in the world. and I just dropped what I was doing. And I spent 2 years at his farm, on and off. Occasionally I went back up to Kyoto where my friends were living, and we practiced some of his techniques up there. And at that time, the One Star Revolution came out in Japanese while I was there. There was another fellow named Kurosawa-san who had just come back from the United States, where he had visited organic farms. He went to the Rodale farm, he went to the Bloomberg farm, he went to Ruth Stout's place. He visited the Nearings, well, they were still alive then, and he was going to stay at Fukuoka's farm for a year and then go and start farming himself. And so between Kurosawa and me and then another friend named Chris Pierce was a friend of mine from the communes, and he had grown up in Japan. He knew Japanese and English perfectly. He gave us a direct draft translation. Kurosawa-san and I, after working, would sit down with Fukuoka-sensei and go over the manuscript and work out the inconsistencies and the apparent, like, what are you saying here? And it seems like you said something else over there. And we worked all of that out. And then it was my job to bring the manuscript back to the United States. And if you don't mind, since we're celebrating the republication of the book, let me just take just a little. I don't usually go into this detail about how the book was published, but if you don't mind, it's a pretty interesting story. So I came back to the United States with this manuscript. None of us were professional writers. We were, you know, well, we were adventurers, farmers, idealists. We had no particular skill at writing, but we had something we thought was meaningful. And so when I brought it back to the United States, because of the contact of Gary Snyder and the communes, I went to see Gary Snyder at a poetry reading that he gave in Berkeley. I approached him after the talk, after the reading, and I said, you know, we've got this manuscript. He had heard of Fukuoka-san. He had high respect, also didn't know the details. And he said, you know, this isn't for me. You ought to send it to Wendell Berry. And he wrote out Wendell's address, and he said, tell Wendell that I told you to send it. Okay. I don't know if are you familiar with these names?
Yeah.
For the most part? Okay. I sent it to Wendell Berry, and within a week, I got a telephone call. Not a letter, a telephone call. And it's Wendell. He says, you have a publisher for this book? I said, no. I think I can help you with that. So he read it, and in spite of how crummy it was, I mean the language, the way it was done, he saw the importance of what was in it. He took the book under his wing, and he wanted it to reach farmers. So he suggested Rodale Press, where he had been working with them too, and because they had that book club, and he could get the book right into the middle America. He didn't want it just to go to macrobiotics and spiritual people. He wanted it to go to farmers. And he said, if you do Rodale, I'll help with the copy editing. And so for the next year and a half, Wendell and I, along with my good friend Wayne Olson and my mother, we edited that book. A year and a half it took. 30 pages back to Kentucky, back to Bay Area, back to Los Angeles, back to Kentucky, back and forth. And then when we had to turn out a new draft, it was before word processing. It took like 3 days with my mom and my friend Wayne. They took 2.5 hour shifts to turn out a new draft. And anyway, the book, the reason I'm mentioning this is when you read The One Star Revolution, it's not like any other book. And it's not only the philosophy and the basic understanding that Fukuoka-san had, but the book reads like poetry. I don't know a better okay, I'm tooting my horn a little bit here, but the English is fantastic. It reads like poetry. It's prose, but it reads like poetry. And that's thanks to the fact that we had a poet who was editing, Wendell. And people don't know that Wendell was so much a part of this book. He wrote the preface, but he was so much a part of it. I've kept you waiting long enough. Slides. Okay, shall we do that?
How old was he when you first met him?
he was about 62 or 63 years old. And, you know, I'm 60 right now. So when I met him, he was my age, essentially. And he seemed so old. But he was totally full of energy. Nobody could keep up with him. He'd go up and down the hillsides, and he would show, okay, at the time, we'll see pictures of it, but he invited students to come and live in these mud-walled huts in the orchard, and the students, you know, worked all day, and he would come up pretty much every day and instruct us on how to use the tools and his farming technique and the philosophy, and he would give us about, 10,000 yen. At the time, it was $35 for a month for the whole, all the group. And that was to buy oil for cooking and soy sauce, because those were things that you can't really produce practically on a small scale. So we could buy that, and otherwise, everything that we used and everything we ate or did, you know, were things that were on the farm that we grew or and so forth. Oh, and I didn't mention, Fukuoka-san, unfortunately, sadly, passed away last year. He was 95 years old. Yeah. And so, excuse me if I haven't quite gotten used to it yet, and so I might use present tense or past tense. This is very close to Fukuoka's village, but not quite. But this is during the rice harvest, and the rice is hung up to dry on these racks for about 2 weeks before it's threshed. And then they have a problem getting rid of the rice and what to do with it. They generally burn it and sometimes make compost with it, but they don't put it back on the fields. But Japan is about the size of California, but instead of 25 or 30 million people, they have 125 or 130 million people, something like that. And it's mostly mountainous. So the people are really crammed in together. And it's one of those places where if you're a cultural geographer, oh, you're in heaven, because the landscape, you know, the geography has really molded the culture there. And people know exactly what's expected of them. It's a hierarchy and independent thinking, like Fukuoka's way of thinking, which was so different, is not particularly prized. In fact, it's the opposite. So, okay, and also here, see where the village is? They don't have the luxury of building on the productive farmland. There just isn't that much productive farmland. So this village was probably sited there, 1,000 years ago, but they put it in just the right place, right in the foothills, but not on the productive farmland like we're doing. So here's the orchard is up here. We'll be going up there in a second. And the only reason I put this in is to show that even in the side valleys, that the where it's steep, they still made terraces to use every possible square foot for rice production. And also there's this little bamboo grove. Bamboo is so useful for a million different things. And every village has at least one or two bamboo groves of different types of bamboo, just because it's really practical. Okay, this is a kind of an overview of the orchard. And this is all the citrus trees. And there are taller trees in here. We'll see a little more of them in a minute. And here's the roofs of the mud-walled huts where the students lived and where he lived all during the time that he was developing his farming. So here's one of the huts. And, you know, these were, they were very simple affairs. It's just one room, and the bedding was piled in a corner, and there was a hole in the center. There's tatami mats and a hole in the center. There's a picture in a second where the meals were cooked. Chickens running around, goats. He had a hog or two when I was there, but he didn't raise animals commercially, except that he had them running around, and Well, the doors, we didn't bother to put the doors up on these huts very much, especially in the summer, and the chickens ran around and made a mess, and it was absolutely wonderful staying there, frankly. Here's another one of the huts.
It's mud.
It's mud. It's clay on lath. So you put up a bamboo, screen kind of, and then stick the mud right on it. That's pretty much it. And this is bamboo roof. The traditional Japanese farmhouses use rice straw for the roof. There's a picture coming up. So here's, these trees are the overstory. He had, I think the main couple of trees were, well, acacia. That's what these are. And locust trees. And neither one of them are native to Japan, which brings up the issue that I'm sure you've talked about in this permaculture design course, native and non-native and so forth. And Fukuoka's idea is that it's way, way, way too late to try to put everything back to where natives are in their place and back where they are. People are all mixed up. We're traveling everywhere. We got seeds on our shoes. We've got plants, and the soil conditions are completely different, and we've got a critical time. If we got to plant more trees, he became a fanatic about that in his last 20 years. More trees, any kind of trees, and acacia trees. One of the reasons that Australian trees are so useful is because the soil in Australia, just naturally, it's pretty much the oldest soil in the world, naturally, and it's kind of worn out. It's very poor soil, and so the plants like grevillea and acacia and so forth, these plants are adapted to poor soil. And since we've messed up so much soil by overgrazing and overlogging and agriculture, and we've got poor soil now on so much land, of course the Australian trees are going to be really practical because they're used to that. It's just their cup of tea or whatever. So when he discovered acacia, he just loved it. It's a nitrogen fixer, attracts all kinds of insects, grows like crazy. So these trees are probably 10 years old. And after 10 or 12 years, he cuts them down, uses the wood for various projects and plants more trees. So that fertilizes the soil deep down and provides all kinds of good things. So that's the upper story. The uppermost story is acacias and locust and other really tall trees, nut trees, walnuts, for example, and others. Then he's got the next story is the fruit trees, and it's not only citrus, but he's got persimmons and plums and peaches and apricots and all of that. And he's got native and non-native. He doesn't really care about native and non-native. And at one point, I remember he was just sitting there, and he, for no reason at all, he said, "You know, Larry, I think we should have one world government." I said, "Oh, really?" He says, yeah, I think that would be a really good thing. Okay, so I'm just, some of these things that I'm going to tell you as we go on here, these are, I want you to kind of get an idea of who Fukuoka-san is or was, personality. He you won't read in the books, but he was a really cool guy, and he was eccentric, and stubborn, and full of energy. And if he were speaking tonight, okay, I don't know what time it is now, but in 3 hours, we would have lost, most people in the back would have been gone, and then he'd be talking, and then finally, he'd be the last one standing. He would just keep talking and going on. He was driven by this vision. Every single day, he woke up by this vision that he had when he was on the bluff over Yokohama. Every single day. And he said, "What can I do today to show people that this vision can be of real practical benefit to humanity. How can I do that today? How much can I do today? One of the things that he loved people. And he didn't care if you're a farmer or if you're an auto mechanic or if you're an artist. He just loved people. And when we sat down when we were in Los Angeles, as he stayed over at my parents' house, and we've got some stories about Los Angeles coming up, he would just sit down and say, "What do you do? Tell me about it. Tell me who you are." And when we were in Berkeley once, he loved, I don't know if you people know Telegraph Avenue. It's the main drag that goes right to the Berkeley campus, and it's where all the really wild people, you know, kind of hang out, and he loved it. He loved Telegraph because people were so free. And there was one day that I will never forget because he really took me down one day. We were sitting in a coffee shop, and this fellow walked in. He was a young guy, black leather, chains, mohawk, bright red spikes. And I must have made a comment something like, "I guess it takes all kinds, or you never know who you're going to bump into on Telegraph," or something like that. He scolded me. He says, "Don't ever judge somebody by their appearance, you know, or by, you know, you got to get to know somebody. You can't just look at somebody and judge them." And I felt about this big, you know. So here's the upper story, and then the citrus trees. And on the surface, you know, is a lot of weeds and also medicinal plants and herbs and wild vegetables growing everywhere in the spaces between the orchard trees. We'll get to that in a second. So this is inside one of the huts. And so there's the stove. That's it. One burner. And he's just making tea, but generally our meals were one big pot of something. And we rotated the cooking chores. And whoever was cooking, right when he started heating up the water or whatever, he'd say, "Well, I need a couple of, I need some burdock, and I need some cucumbers, and I need some this and some that." And then the students would just go out and harvest them because we had been working in we knew exactly where they were growing. They weren't in rows. There was nothing like rows. They were just here and there, and we would find them by, you know, accidentally kicking them. And say, "Oh, yeah, I kicked a cucumber over there. I'll go get it," you know. And it reminds me, okay, I was in Micronesia for a while, and the same thing. You go for a cookout, and you go down to the beach, and they start the fire, and then they go out to fish. It's like, "Oh, just go out and catch the fish and bring them back." And it was the same thing, you know, with the farm. So here is some of the students. These two guys had been living there for about 2 years when I was there. This is Kurosawa, the other translator, and this is, well, that's me at about 24 years old. So we know that this is November. How do we know it's November? These guys, those are peeled persimmons hanging to dry. And they've got to be ready. New Year's, it's a dried persimmons is a big New Year's thing. So, okay. Remember, I mentioned wild radish and mustard to improve the orchard, to the soil in the orchard. Well, there it is, going wild. Well, some might say that has become invasive. So then we bring up the invasive species issue, and Fukuoka-san refers to invasive, quote, what we call invasive species, Fukuoka calls hard workers. He loves them. And he understands that, quote, invasive species are pioneer species that come in to on wasted land because somehow they have an advantage because they can survive on poor soil. And then after a while, they improve the soil enough so they lose their competitive advantage, and then you go on to the next level of succession. But they work so hard, and he doesn't want to do the work. He can just scatter the seeds, and then they reseed themselves. So the story that I promised the people at the permaculture class today, the Scotch broom story. Okay, he gave a talk in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada on a little farm there. And He was talking about hardworking species, and he said, you know, how much he liked them. You just have to learn how to manage them. And one of them is white clover, which is not so horrible unless you're up in the Maritime in Washington where it rains all the time, and white clover is really invasive, and people were horrified when he was suggested planting white clover in the garden. Okay, he said, plant it and then learn to work with it, learn to deal with it. So he's in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, and he's saying, you know, the landscape, California is becoming a desert, and it's been overgrazed, and it's been overlogged. It took him 2 seconds to see what was happening in California. 2 seconds. And then he said, nature is going to help and bring this land back if people don't interfere yet again. And he said, for example, I love this plant. And he pointed to a whole hillside of Scotch broom, which the people around Nevada City in that area, that's their worst, they consider it their worst weed, the nightmare. And he said, it's a nitrogen fixer. It's the best thing nature can possibly do. It's a hard worker. You know, you can find a way. You know, if you want to, you can speed it up by digging out a section and planting something which will eventually shade it out and so forth. But he, so again, I'm just telling you, these are issues that people, you know, in the sustainable agriculture movement and permaculture struggle with this kind of thing. So I'm just telling you where he stands on these. But he did say, when he went to the Olympic Peninsula, that, okay, if you've got an area like this that's almost all native, that's pristine, you should do whatever you can to preserve it. But that's only about 2 or 3% these days. So work hard on that, but don't waste your energy trying to put the other 98% back to native, because we haven't got time for that. This is a crisis. Plant anything that'll grow. The more trees, the better. And he thought that and also his idea about stopping desertification in Africa. You know, he went to Somalia, he went to India, he went to Europe twice, and his idea of turning the tide against desertification in the Sahara region was to gather up seeds of all different kinds and scatter them from airplanes, especially in areas where there's at least a little bit of water to start with, and then build from there. And he said it's great if the airplanes were planes that were once used for warfare. It would be great if you could convert those to this purpose. And I remember one time we were at Amherst College at a macrobiotic, one of these Nichio Kushi East-West summer camps. Somebody said, you mean we should include the seeds of all plants? And he goes, yes, all the plants. He says, well, what about thistle? And then he went, well, let me think about that. So growing vegetables like wild plants, he mixed the seeds of all different vegetables together. He didn't want to use his mind to say, well, tomatoes will go well here, and the eggplants will go well here, and so forth. He mixed the seeds of all different plants together, scattered them out in the spaces between the orchard trees, put them out there, cut the grass and the weeds, and let them fall right on top. And then whatever came up, came up. So nature would decide where the daikon, in this case, this is a patch of daikon. That's probably third or fourth generation. It's seeded itself, and the plants are much stronger when they seed themselves. They grow much stronger. They revert back to a slightly bitter flavor of their semi-wild ancestors, and we talked about that a little bit this afternoon, but that's not a bad thing. The flavor is absolutely great. It takes about a week or 10 days when you live in place where the vegetables are semi-wild. It takes about 10 days, and then you go, oh, this is a wonderful flavor. It's because your palate adjusts to the flavor, and then your body somehow feels, oh, this, it just feels, this is so good for me. It's a whole body feeling. So anyway, so here's a patch of wild daikon, and here's one of the daikon. That's about fourth generation, just a volunteer. Okay, this is, you know, one of the citrus trees that was left unpruned. So that's kind of big, but it's pretty productive. This is a good time for me to mention one other thing. I'm going off on digressions. I hope you don't mind. Pardon? Oh, this is, this is mandarin oranges. This is the kind that, the main cash crop at his farm is what they call Satsuma mandarins that you can get all around here. Satsuma is a region of southern Japan that's very close to where he lives. Again, the main point of view that he has is that it's the intellect that separates people from nature. And he says, if you look at this tree and you see the orange of the fruit and the green of the leaves, you're already on the wrong track. You've already separated. You know, it's a distinction. Your mind is noticing differences, and there are really no differences. And he calls his agriculture, among other things, what we said is do-nothing agriculture, is natural farming. It's also mu agriculture, which means nothing, literally. And it's probably the most important character in all of Chinese and Japanese literature. It's emptiness. They see the emptiness, we see the form, kind of. And all of the arts in Japan, they are leading towards this state where the practitioner is just acting with not thinking at all. Just the hands are moving and the spirit is just coming right through. And the Zen people often call it beginner's mind or child mind or whatever. And anyway, Fukuoka really was into that. And it's the state of mind, the mu part of agriculture is the state of mind of the farmer when you go out into the field, that there's no distinction between the rice and the insects and the soil, and it's just all one. And he really didn't like science very much because of the way science kind of tends to divide things into specialties. Okay. That's his son down at the bottom, who is now managing the farm. He's probably in his 70s now. He's a cool guy, and I think the farm is being run as an organic farm, but I don't know the details. I wish I did. So here's a sequence of slides of the grain growing. I don't think we have that many grain growers. I'll go through this pretty quickly. There's a harvest of the rice, and he just lets the rice sit on the fields instead of hanging them on a rack. And then after the rice is threshed, then all of the, it's spread back over the field. And this is the barley coming up. The barley is the spring crop. The rice has already been seeded, but it doesn't sprout until the spring. So all of the seeding is done in the fall. And the clover seed goes out in the fall as well. So in the spring, the rice is coming up through the clover ground cover. So this is a picture of the rice that I was trying to describe before. You know, I wish I had a picture of the neighbor's rice as a contrast, but this is what his rice looks like. Short, squat, dark green, loaded with grains to the head. Well, this is my favorite picture, being a soil scientist. This is a profile of the soil in his fields, in his rice field. You would have no idea that there was agriculture being practiced. If you looked at that soil profile, it looks just like a grass, the soil that you would expect in a grass ecosystem. You've got the top couple of inches is stained dark with organic matter and a lot of life and roots and air and so forth. This is the topsoil, which also is dark colored with organic matter. This layer right here, it's a little bit gray, and that's left over from the 2 weeks, about 2 weeks. He holds water in the field to slow down the clover until the rice comes through, and then he lets the water out of the field, and the clover comes back as a ground cover. And that's anaerobic, you know, no air in the field for those 2 weeks, and you get different microorganisms, and that creates a gray layer. And the soils, for example, in Holland, most of them are gray and they smell bad, and it's all because of anaerobic. It's the same process. And then the subsoil. But, you know, to see a natural soil profile in an agricultural field is exactly what you would expect to find in a field that hasn't been plowed for 30 years.
Yeah. Is that red clay down there kind of what you started off with in the rest of what you built up?
Yeah.
How thick is that? Just curious.
Well, here's the tool. You know, this is about 2 feet. So we're down to about, let's say, 30 inches top to bottom, something like that. But the neighbors, there's no layers at all. It's pea soup. You know, they just flood the field. So Fukuoka does not flood his rice fields. He's probably the only rice farmer in Japan that doesn't flood his rice fields. He thinks rice grows better that way. And the people have been growing rice in a flooded field for so long, they forgot why they're doing it. Mainly it's for weed control. But now it's just a habit, frankly.
How many years old was the soil?
How old were the soils?
That he's been doing that kind of farming when you took that picture.
Oh, well, that picture was 30 years. That's been about 30 years of no-till farming. So here's a couple of slides from the farm in the mountains of northern Kyoto, where I was living with my counterculture friends. This is the rice thatched roof. It needs to be replaced about every 25 years, so once a generation. And these trees are cryptomeria. They call them the Japanese redwoods, and they are a distant relative of redwoods. And look how straight the trunks are. That's because every couple of years somebody comes along and climbs up the tree and cuts off the branches so that there's no knots and it's perfectly clear wood. So that's pretty intensive forestry, huh? I could tell you more about forestry in Japan, but I'm afraid that I'm just talking too much as it is. So this is a hippies and cops photo. And this is my friend Bill, who lives in Santa Cruz now. And Heidi, that's not really her name. She looks like Heidi. She lives in Port Townsend. And this is, let's see, this is the mayor, chief of police, beat cop. That's Tai Chi. We took over, we rented for $70 a month an old samurai house that was about 350 years old. It was in disrepair. The fields, we brought the fields back into production. We fixed it all up. And so every once in a while, we got a visit from the local people, and we were friends with the neighbors. They were just coming to say hello. Obviously, clearly, this is a happy scene. And the reason that they really liked us is because, first of all, we brought fields back into production. The number one reason was because we worked. They saw that we knew how to work. We worked all day. And then we joined the community projects. Like during the rice transplanting in the spring, the whole village got together and then went from one house to the other. And so everybody spent one day at somebody's house until all the rice was planted. And then they go to somebody else's house. You know, that thing. And we joined in with that. And we were just as productive as any Japanese. So they respected us for that. And that was the ticket. That's why I was able to live at Fukuoka's farm and fit in, because I could work all day. That's the ticket. Yeah, vegetable gardening. It was beautiful there. It was just great. I had such a good time in Japan. I really did. on the communes at Fukuoka's place and this place. I mean, what could be better? Here's the tools. The tools were about this big. People were about this big. Up until World War II, and then when dairy products were added to the diet after World War II during the occupation, in one generation, the Japanese people grew 3 inches taller in one generation when milk products were added to the diet. So this is this is rice hanging to dry, but it's in the place where we lived in northern Kyoto. Isn't that pretty darn cool? I mean, this big, tall thing, structure for hanging rice to dry. I mean, it's art in its own, but it's functional, of course. The rice is off the ground for 2 weeks, and then it's threshed. We grew cover crops in the winter, and this was a traditional cover crop at Vetch. Some of the other farmers, other villagers said, oh, my goodness, I haven't seen a cover crop like this since, you know, in 25 years, or since before World War II, essentially. And one guy was crying when he saw the field. So we tried Fukuoka's technique there with a twist. See the rice straw and the clover, and we tried buckwheat. Why not? So we did buckwheat. Worked fine. Neighbors weeding the rice fields, that's a traditional, and they didn't mind posing for a photo. Yeah, it snowed there. In the winter. It snowed often in the winter, but and then it was kind of hot and muggy in the summer. So here's Fukuoka-san one of his two visits to the United States. Here he is in the mountains. It's about 5,500 feet in the Sierra Nevada. He was the macrobiotic summer camp. And he just, after living in Japan for all of those years, when nobody paid attention to him, and in fact pretty much considered him an eccentric at best and a nut, an outright nut at worst, when he came here after the One Star Revolution was published, and he was like, people were flocking, 100 people here, 200 there, and finally when at the second international permaculture convergence at the Evergreen State College in 1986, I think, almost 800 people, 750 people were there, and he goes, my goodness, he had no idea that there were so many people that were interested in doing, you know, agriculture that would not harm the earth, is the way he put it. Now, this is the Rodale farm. They were working with amaranth at the time. They were trying to bring it back as a cereal grain, and that experiment didn't work out too well. But, you know, he visited the publisher and the farm. Telegraph Avenue, which he loved, and I jumped ahead and told you that story. But we went back to Telegraph one time when he was wearing his Japanese farmer clothes and these wooden shoes that clip-clopped when he walked, and you see him go, you know, walking down the street. Nobody paid any attention to him. He'd like blended in. It was like Telegraph. Anything goes on Telegraph. He loved it there. This is what's called the Integral Urban House, which is, remember, this is the late 70s. It's the very beginning of the movement to try to figure out better ways of doing everything. So we got bees and wind and gardening, and they had a self-composting toilet, and they had big water tanks on the south-facing windows to heat the house. And they, you know, it's an example of urban homesteading and how, you know, all the good stuff that we're perfecting these now. This was the very beginning. They had a little pond, yeah. Even though it was a postage stamp backyard, they did have a pond, in fact. So where are we here? Here's a hint. Tassajara. Yeah, good one. It's a Zen Center farm at, not Tassajara, but Green Gulch. It's in Marin County, and that's a farm, you know, it's a place where Fukuoka loved it there. It was farming and spiritual practice, and what he loved the most was that they took the barn. It's kind of like what we're doing here. They took the barn and they remodeled it into a zendo. Their main zendo was an old barn, and he thought that was really cool. And there were people like here, if there were people living upstairs, that's what they, if you've ever been to Green Gulch, that's what it's like, the barn and living quarters right there. And you wake up at 4:30 in the morning, gong, gong, and do the meditation practice, and then right out into the fields. It's a very nice place. And if you walk about a mile and a half down the road, you come to Muir Beach and the beautiful Pacific Ocean, and it's really nice. These are giant sequoias. It's a little area. It's a national. It's a state monument. It's a little area that wasn't glaciated. It had these two giant sequoias. They're the farthest north of any giant sequoias in the Sierra Nevada, and also ancient communities of plants. It goes back, well, it's not ancient, but it goes back three ice ages, 80,000 years farther than just over there. And so he walked through there, he loved it, and he thought that he saw the similarities between the ancient flora of California and Japan. He saw it very clearly. There are native forests in Japan, unbelievably. There are still, including on Shikoku Island, where he's from. So we visited a place in the Coast Range in California where one of his students was living. So that's where this is from. There's another almost identical photo coming up. I should have edited better. And he's always busy with his pen and ink, always drawing, always with his little diagrams which explain his philosophy. And somebody comes and you have a conversation and go, oh, wait a minute, sit down, spend a few minutes here. So many people walked away with these drawings that he did. This one in particular is the most famous of them, and this is the Cave of the Intellect. Remember that one, Mom? Cave of the Intellect? Here's the cave, and here's the two people working with picks. And that is the Cave of the Intellect. They're trying to figure things out. They're trying to solve the problems of society or of whatever by using their mind and the discriminating mind. That's the mind that understands up and down, east and west, beneficial insect, pest insect. If your mind responds to that kind of dichotomy, you're working away. You're stuck. And the more you work, then the deeper the cave gets and the harder it is to get out. And then there's this, you can't see it so clearly, but right here, there's a person that's relaxing with his arm up, he's just taking it easy, and that's the natural farmer who's got time to sing a song, and he's got time to write poetry. This is the parking strip in front of my parents' house in Los Angeles. Now, we had been in Boston and took a plane. Okay, Sensei's about 65. He's never been outside of Japan before, never been on an airplane before. And we did this tour and went from Boston to Los Angeles. And the plane took the southern route that went over Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and then finally Los Angeles. So it's desert for 2.5 hours. And then 14 million people, Los Angeles. So again, my parents, Vivian and Irving, decided, hey, why don't we take city streets instead of taking the freeway? So we went through Beverly Hills and Brentwood and the really ritzy West Side. And if you've been there, I can just describe it anyway. They're all mansions with a big lawn and foundation plants. That's plants right along the house, which are generally tropical plants, and then annuals in a row right along the path to the front door. So Fukuoka sensei, he's looking out, he's first of all horrified that there are 14 million people living in the desert to begin with. And he's looking out and he says, oh my goodness, all these people come and live in the desert, and what do they plant? They plant tropical plants and lawn, which requires extra water. This is horrible. But then his wife, Ayako, is also looking out the back window, and she says, look, all these people come and live in the desert, and look what a beautiful surroundings they've created. Look what beautiful surroundings they've created for themselves. I'm not making judgment on that story. I'm just telling you that that happened, and it's interesting. So look around. It's all concrete or landscape plants or lawn. He called lawn artificial green because to him, lawn was like green pavement because it covered up whatever nature was going to do there before. His idea of eco-terrorism is to fill your pockets. He says, people, fill your pockets with radish and mustard seeds, make a little tiny hole and walk around in the golf courses. You know, and pay special attention to those flat areas near the flag. So, but this is the only place where he could find soil, and he's looking for what nature is trying to do. We did go to Griffith Park and see, you know, so we did get an idea. But in a residential place, it's you can't see anything about what nature was trying to do. This was his last stop before going back to Japan. And when we went to the airport, Sensei said to me, said, Larry, thank you so much for bringing me to Los Angeles. You know, we've been to such beautiful places. We went to the Olympic Mountains, and we went to these farms and all this stuff. Why Los Angeles? Said, because this is the place that I really felt from talking to people that I got an idea of how far people can be separated from nature. I had no idea before. And that a lot of it came down to this one conversation that he had with a woman who is a perfectly nice conversation and so forth. And he asked her, how do you feel about living in the desert like this? And she said something like, well, frankly, if you ask me, it's really inconvenient when it rains. I like living in the desert because it never rains. When it rains, I hate it. And that was it. That was like, I won't say that he loved it. He didn't love it. It was the opposite. But it did give him, like he said, it showed him how far people can be removed from nature. That they 14 million people decide to live in the desert and they think that it's inconvenient when it rains. So, okay, we're just about done with these here. Oh, well, okay. I just threw that one in. That is Wendell Berry. After we worked on the book, he invited me to come out there, and I stayed for a couple of weeks with him, and then a couple of weeks with other friends of his. Pardon me?
Where is his place?
It's in Kentucky. It's right on the Kentucky River. It's about 45 minutes north of Lexington. And so while I was there, he didn't mind. I snapped a few photos, and here he is just mowing the hay. Of course, he's famous among other things, besides being famous for his poetry and his essays and his novels. He's also, of course, famous for being at the forefront of the draft horse, you know, people say, let's use draft horses. There's so many ways and so many situations when draft horses are absolutely the very best form of power. And, you know, when I talked to him, I hadn't talked to him for a long time, and I talked to him on the phone about 4 or 5 months ago. And I said, Wendell, you still have your team? And he goes, yep. So he's probably, I think he's 75 or 76 years old now. And, of course, a real, real inspiration. So this is, well, that's his house right there. And let's see. That's just about the right position. It's very hard to tell. I think that's the Kentucky River. It was muddy at the time. It was spring, and so there was a lot of mud and silt in the river. Yeah, that's it. That's it. Because, see, the river's going like this and then turning here and going like that. So that's how close he is. He's got bottom land. And it was really interesting, some of the issues that he brought up, including really defending growing tobacco and how important it was for small farmers. And he said, if they stop the tobacco, this is 1979, and he said, if they stop the tobacco subsidy, a third of the farmers in this county are gone. And he said, if that happens, it's not like people are going to stop smoking. It's not like we're not going to continue growing tobacco. It's going to be raised by conglomerates in over North Carolina. And the only effect is going to be that this great crop for small farmers, where they get a premium for growing high quality, and you can actually make a living on fairly small scale, well, that's going to be gone. And that's exactly what happened. And sure enough, a third of the farmers in his county, overnight, gone. So, but it opened my eyes. You know, I said, oh, tobacco subsidy. I was always non-thinking. Get rid of the tobacco subsidy. But then, well, it's just throwing it out there. So here's, okay, we got, this is Sensei, the last two slides are just for fun. Fukuoka with his grandson, who's now 37 years old. Just a great shot of him with in a barley field. Yeah, pretty much. It's a clear cut, and they're growing citrus there. It's stupid. It's way stupid. It's not his fields, believe me. So again, just to wrap this up and to reiterate the most often quoted section in the One Straw Revolution, that the ultimate goal of farming is not just growing crops. It's the cultivation and perfection of human beings and communities and everything connected with people, too, as what's implied there. So, I be done.